Happy February 7th, 2020. Happy Black History Month, everybody. Happy Lovers Month. It's great. We're off to rock and roll in February. And my young producer, my young millennial, my darling Jason Y, has laryngitis and no voice, but he is in studio, so I feel like I'm doing my show with Harpo Marx today. And if you don't know who Harpo Marx is, that probably means you're under 40. But I've got my... And I'll be here all week. But he's got control of the board, so who knows what he'll be playing for us. Anyway, we got a great lineup for you all today. Let me tell you what we're doing. We're starting out with Thomas Davis, African-American male, openly gay, worked for the Black AIDS Institute for a while. And we're going to talk a bit about what it means to be black and gay in America in 2020, where we've been, where we're going. And then after that, we're going to have a call-in from Michael Griffiths, who is an incredible Australian singer, and he's got some upcoming shows. He's paying tribute to Madonna. Yes, that Madonna. My Madonna. Yeah. And Cole Porter. He's got back-to-back shows coming up. And so we'll talk a little bit about his tributes to Madonna and Cole Porter. And then returning guest, Betsy Butler, former California State Assemblywoman and now the head of the Women's Law Center, talking about women in politics and what's happening nationally, locally, and the women's current state of the women's movement. And then she'll be sticking with me all the way to the top of the hour when we'll have my old pal Jarrett Hill pop in. Another voice for Black History Month. And we'll be having African-American voices popping in throughout the entire month. So that is our lineup for the day. But if you haven't been paying attention to politics, if you've been living under a rock, then you probably haven't seen the last 48 hours in the incredible news cycle that we're in, because it appears that Pete Buttigieg has won the Iowa caucus. I am old enough to know and remember that I never, ever, ever thought I would see the day when an openly LGBT person would be running for president of the United States. But it's happening. And not only is it happening, he won the Iowa caucuses by a sliver over Bernie Sanders. But by a sliver, he did win the Iowa caucuses. And now they're off to New Hampshire. And it appears that Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg are again running neck in neck for the New Hampshire primary, and then off to South Carolina and Nevada. So how exciting is it that we are in the midst of a battle for the Democratic nominee? And we've got so many good choices, gang. My candidate was Kamala Harris, the U.S. Senator from California, known her since she was the San Francisco DA. I thought she would have made a great president. She jumped out of the race, and I have not yet committed to anyone. Yeah, I love Pete Buttigieg, but, you know, I know Joe Biden from the days when he was Barack Obama's vice president, and I was very tight with that campaign when that happened many years ago. And I got to tell you, I'm just, Michael Bloomberg is a possibility. And yes, I like Elizabeth, and so I'm and Bernie, and it's like, they're all anybody. But the orange pumpkin, guys, anybody, I'm okay with, and I hope you are too, because watching the complainer in chief, you know, he got acquitted by the U.S. Senate. And by the way, kudos to Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney has gone up mega points in my book. I don't agree with him on a lot, but man, he's got spine, he's got courage and backbone. But, you know, when Bill Clinton got impeached and acquitted, he issued an apology to the American people for putting us all through the impeachment. He took responsibility for his actions. He said he was sorry, expressed remorse, and allowed the country to heal and move forward. Not this guy, not 45. He apologized to his family, that his family went through it, completely not even thinking that maybe the other 250 million of us that call this place home might have been going through some turmoil over the past months about his corrupt scheme and his trying to use Ukraine for political leverage for his reelect, and trying to throw the Bidens under the bus and trying to cover it up and obstructing Congress and all those things that he did. You think he would have issued an apology to the American people as well. But no, we didn't get an apology from the commander in chief. We didn't get anything other than Democrats are evil and sick and so on and so on. So we'll be talking about that throughout the course of the day with my various guests as they pop in and out. But we first need to welcome my first guest who's just walked into studio, and our first guest is Thomas Davis. So You know who that is, Thomas. Change is going to come by. It's okay.
Oh, I've heard it.
Baby, you're a millennial.
I know. You get me. I don't know everything when it comes
it's
to
Sam Cooke.
Okay. I've heard it, though.
He was around before even I was around, but it's still a beautiful song. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. Really happy to be here.
I know you were here before when you accompanied the new executive director of the Black AIDS Institute, right?
Rania Copeland.
About, I don't know, 7-8 months ago or so.
Something like that.
But I'm so glad you're here because I'm going to have various African-American voices throughout the month. Black History Month. But
amazing.
You're the first.
Awesome. I'm honored to be here. So,
now, you were born and raised in Los Angeles?
No, I actually was born in Texas originally, but I grew up in Colorado, and then I moved out here in 2010 and have been here ever since. So this is home.
So where in Texas were you born?
Georgetown. It's real small town.
Small town.
Like central. Yeah.
Central Texas.
Yeah.
And then moved to what part of Colorado?
It's another small town called Estes Park. It's actually where The Shining takes place. So it's interesting.
One of my favorite movies. Now, I mean, growing up, were you one of the few black kids in town or school? Mm-hmm. Or?
Yeah, so my school had about maybe 500 kids in it, tops. And in my grade, I was the only black student that we had. My brother was also black, but he was in the grade below me. So in total, in the whole school, we had about four, you know, that were African-American or black.
Wow, compared to Los Angeles, that's completely upside down.
Oh, yes. I always said that, like, coming out here was, like, the best culture shock I ever got. So it was cool.
And then I'm guessing, being the only one of four black kids in high school, you were probably the only gay.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I came out when I was a freshman, so, yeah, that's kind of just how it was. I was the black gay kid.
Wow. All right, coming up next, gang, we'll be talking more to Thomas Davis about what it was like. Like growing up as the only black kid in Colorado small town. Thanks for tuning in here on Channel Q.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
I know you have no idea who that is, right,
Nina
Thomas?
Nina Simone.
Oh, you do.
Of course.
Yes, I love Nina. I am so happy that you knew that because often young people, millennials, don't. But obviously, African American millennial, you knew exactly who that was.
Yeah, I know who she is. Of course.
Yeah. She's eternal. She was all about race and racism, and brought her voice to that conversation. So you're in a small town.
Yes.
You're like one of four black kids in the high school. You're the only openly. Well, you weren't probably openly gay, were
I
you?
I was.
You were openly gay?
I came out when
in
I
a
was
small town
15,
in Colorado?
Yep, 2 weeks before I turned 16, I came out. Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
So I was young.
And during the break, you and I were chatting, and you were adopted. You were raised by two very white, conservative, Republican parents.
Yeah. So I have my parents that adopted me are both white, and then I had three older sisters that were white as well. My brother, he was adopted as well, but it was a year later. We're not related by DNA. So he was black as well, but that's what I grew up with. They're very, they are still conservative.
Right.
It was it was interesting.
So here we are. I'm trying to picture this. So here you are. You're in a small town. It's mostly white. You're in a family that's mostly white. You're in a state that's mostly white.
Yes.
And you're African American. How do you find, or did you search for attachments to your Afro culture, or hunger for it, or anything?
Yeah. Well, I mean, for me, when I was growing up, I mean, me being adopted was always something that we just talked openly about. We always knew, you know, it was just what always was. So for me, I mean, I always was the one that just kind of stuck out. So I got used to kind of being a loner and being, you know, the one that was different. So I never really looked into my culture, my roots as like somebody that is black. It wasn't really until I got to college, when I had other, you know, peers that were black, that were Latino, that were from all over the world. But yeah, growing up, it wasn't something that I was told was that important. It was, you know, I just kind of was focused on getting through school and, you know, getting out of there so I could be somewhere more diverse.
And when for me, so when I went to college, Cal State Long Beach, I mean, I was raised in a community that was all Latino and Jewish. That was the only type of kids on the block, Latino and Jewish, East LA.
Yeah.
I had never seen a black person until my first day of college.
Wow.
Other than on television.
That's crazy.
Is that crazy? Mm-hmm. But in my entire neighborhood, it was just not something common, not in church, mm-hmm. not in school, not on the street. Mm-hmm. And I went to Cal State Long Beach and I was like, oh. African American people, black people.
Yeah.
But I had never seen that until I went to college. And then that kind of opened up all sorts of questions and worlds for me.
Yeah.
Like you.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really interesting too. When I talked to my sister when she was growing up, I remember she describes watching this, it was like this jewelry ad, like for like Jared or something like that. I don't know. It was in the 90s. And I remember she saw it was this interracial couple. It was a black man and a white woman. And they like, you know, kissed on it. And it was this whole thing where she like asked my sister like, oh, like, does that happen? And it was really interesting to see, like, you know, when people grow up, you know, you grow up in these kind of isolated bubbles, and then when you get out and you see something, it's like, oh, like, you know, it really kind of pulled into focus for me that I was like, wow, like, we know we're, you know, my sister is like maybe like 8 years older than me, and this still was a new experience for her. It kind of showed me that we're not as far, you know, removed from you know, segregation and all of that as much as we think we are. So, you know, it's like, that was like when my grandparents were like my age, you know? So it's when I think about that, it's like, wow, okay. Like, that wasn't that long ago.
Yeah. So here it is. It's 2020. How old are you?
27.
All right. 27. It's 2020. Wow. That's, wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you're young. Right. You're like Jason. Jason's young too.
All right, good.
Do you ever get a sense of racism walking around the streets?
Yes. Yeah.
Well,
definitely.
How does that look?
You know, for me, when I first got out here, I remember the first time I ever like blatantly like really experienced racism was when I was walking back from my musical theater class, and it was me and you know, the other students in my class were black, and I remember we were walking, and there was this guy that was across the street, and he was just yelling, and you know, I think he was experiencing homelessness, so at first I wasn't really listening, and then, you know, I heard him screaming, you know, the N-word, and I was like, who's he talking to? And I look across the street, and he's like looking at me, and he's pointing at me, and like my friends, they just start going off, and I remember I was like, wait, like, He's talking to me. Like, it was crazy.
It was shocking.
Yeah, it was crazy. I remember that was my first experience, like experiencing it like that blatant and loud. But then I think after that, and you know, once I graduated from college and started to get more into my line of work and like public health and everything, it was starting to realize like, oh, like realizing what and learning what microaggressions were, and really realizing that I, you know, am surrounded by that pretty much every single day as a black man, and you know, coming to terms with that. And yeah, it was a lot. It was a lot, you know, and it kind of had me questioning a lot of things from, you know, how I grew up. You know, I was looking at a lot of things like when I was growing up, and people would be talking about, you know, how they just loved that, you know, I was, you know, that I was a black kid, but, you know, I wasn't like black. And it was like, you know,
what,
like,
does that mean?
Yeah, no, it was exactly. And it was so weird. Like when I was growing up, I had no idea what that was. And I think, you know, and I felt like, oh, like, you know, they're accepting me. And then growing up and looking back and realizing, oh, like, that was actually really messed up. So, you know, I think that's been a lot of my journey, really, you know, kind of making peace with how, you know, I grow up and not holding on to a lot of the anger and resentment that comes with it. But, you know, just kind of realizing like, okay, like that's what it was. And, you know, I was able, I've been able to look back on those experiences and have it inform, you know, where I go now. But yeah, it's a layered.
You know, I played Nina Simone for you. Nina Simone was around in the 50s and 60s, and mm-hmm. most people wouldn't know her. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. You knew her. You were born in 93. 92. How did you, and I imagine Nina Simone was not mm-hmm. introduced to you mm-hmm. in Colorado. Mm-hmm. How did you?
You know, I was so lucky that I had a choir director that he really made sure that the types of music that we would sing and that we would bring into, you know, was very diverse and was from different cultures. So, yeah, that's actually how I learned about Nina was through one of her songs that we sang that wasn't as well known. I can't remember it. But after that, it was really just like, you know, with a lot of the choreographers that I would work with. I would work with I worked with a lot of black choreographers. You know, in school, I had a lot of black teachers. But even after when I graduated, working with Lula Washington mm-hmm. in South LA, you know, that's how I learned about a lot of stuff, not just with Nina, but you know, with other you know, black musicians and just black art in general. So mm-hmm. yeah, it was for me a lot, like most of what I've learned about, you know, my culture and my roots has been through the arts.
Mm. That's interesting. So mm-hmm. there therefore a black artist that you look up to as a mentor and inspiration mm-hmm. or somebody in music, or mm-hmm. is it, because I mean, we have African-American people prominent obviously in athletics and obviously mm-hmm. in the arts and in mm-hmm. Hollywood and in music mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. Poetry,
yeah, and, yeah,
authors, is there mm-hmm. somebody that,
yeah, I mean of course Alvin Ailey when it comes to dance has been always is a huge inspiration to me. You know, he died from AIDS-related complications as well. So being somebody openly living with HIV, like, he just kind of hits all points for me. And just, mm. you know, his ability to, his ability in his choreography to tell a story that still preserves, like, the history of black Americans and African Americans has just been something that I think has inspired me the most. And mm. just, you know, as a choreographer and a dancer, that's something that I always try to take with me, you know, that, you know, his ability to use storytelling and an art form at the same time to, you know, preserve his culture. So he's a huge inspiration for yeah. sure.
I love Toni Morrison, of course, inspires the heck out of me because she's so smart. So we lost so many African Americans in the arts in the AIDS mm-hmm, epidemic. Mm-hmm. I mean, so many.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, Sylvester, I used to see Sylvester at Studio One in the 70s, way back when. And,
yeah, Sylvester, Joseph Beam, you know, is an amazing poet and writer. You know, like, yeah, lots of really amazing artists.
So we've got like less than a minute. Mm-hmm. So if there's some small town kid mm-hmm. out there listening online, which happens a lot here at Channel Q, who's African American and maybe mm-hmm. gay or lesbian or trans. Mm-hmm. You have any words to impart?
Stay focused. Just stay focused. You know, I think a lot of times, you know, if I could have said something back to myself, it would be like, you know, this isn't, you didn't put yourself in this situation, and it's not to say whether it's good or it's bad. It is what it is. And if you stay focused on the things that you want to do and you want to accomplish, like that's the most important thing, you know, and just making sure you stay true to yourself and, you know, keep your eyes on the prize with that.
I love that. Keep your eyes on the prize.
Yes.
Yeah. Thomas Davis, thanks for coming by.
Of course.
Nice seeing you again. I'm so glad you made it in studio.
Of course. Me too.
Gang, when we come back, coming up next, we'll have Michael Griffiths. We'll be talking about his tribute to Madonna and Cole Porter here on Channel Q.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Gang, that is the incredible, beautiful voice of Michael Griffiths singing one of his tribute songs to Madonna. Michael, welcome to the show.
John, good to be here. How you doing?
Oh, so good. We really love the YouTube videos you sent us. I mean, your voice is amazing, mate.
Thank you. That's very kind.
So you're an Australian. By the way, we've had a whole host of Australians coming on in the past couple of months talking about the wildfires and the terrible devastation.
Oh,
I mean, have you been back home since it happened?
I've just come straight from Australia. I've only landed in the States 2 days ago, and my folks have a beach house that they've kind of retired to on the York Peninsula, south of Adelaide, and they were evacuated in December, and the fire came right to the edge of their town. So certainly there was a day where it, you know, directly touched me. But otherwise, I mean, I've been to Sydney, and it's smoky, and yeah, the whole country is really feeling it. It's been a rough summer, start to the summer.
Our hearts go out to the people of Australia, man. I have so many Aussie friends, and I can't even imagine what's going on there. You're in Las Vegas right now. You're doing a show there, right? That's where you're calling
in
from?
No, I came a few days early. My first time was in LA doing Madonna on Monday, but I wanted to come a few days early to get over jet lag. And I have a couple of Aussie mates here performing, and I'd never been. So I thought, oh, I'll pop over to Las Vegas and see some shows.
Awesome.
Get acclimatized for my first show on Monday.
Stay away from those craps tables. I lose my shirt every time.
I haven't spent a dime yet. I haven't gambled a dollar yet. I may, but I'm not. Gambling's not really my thing. I'm more here to see shows.
That
makes me a massive homo, but yeah, I'm here to see some shows.
I completely get it. That's exactly what I think most LGBT people do. We're there for the shows. Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm seeing Dionne Warwick tonight. That's how excited I am to be here.
You've got some shows coming up in Los Angeles at the Catalina Jazz Club, yes?
Yes, I do. I have a couple a week apart. I was there 3 years ago. I did one night. And I remember it vividly because they have this beautiful gold-plated microphone. I've never seen anything like it at their piano. And it was such a beautiful room. So yeah, very excited to be back in the familiar surroundings.
Why? I mean, I can think of 100 reasons why Madonna or 100 reasons Cole Porter. But I'm curious to hear what are your reasons for doing tributes to each of them.
Look, Madonna I've been doing since 2011, so next year is its 10-year anniversary, and it was at the suggestion of a really dear friend of mine who's a writer, and he'd written a few tribute shows for other performers, and I was in Jersey Boys at the time, and he was my gym buddy, so we'd get together each week, and one week he said, Michael, we should do a show together, what should we do it about? And he'd written a show about Britney Spears for a female Australian who's just done it all over the place, and I thought, oh look, I mean, I grew up, I'm 45 this year, and so Madonna has been just part of the fabric of my life since in sort of some of my earliest pop memories. And I think she's a fantastic songwriter, and that was the way, and I said, let's do a show about Madonna, and let's concentrate on her skills as a songwriter. But, I mean, you know, we're both gays in our 40s, and we like a giggle, so there's lots of sort of bitchy humour, but essentially it's about celebrating a great bunch of songs.
And she's had so many. I mean, Lucky Star, I think, was the first song I remember, like 1980. Mm. Yeah, you were, let me think, were you even around?
Absolutely. One of my first pop memories is Holiday.
Of course.
The Italian girls had it on a cassette, and they used to bring in their kind of little mini ghetto blaster and play Holiday at recess, and we'd all dance in our, you know, neon socks and stonewashed jeans in 1983, 84. And I was, what, 10 years old? I mean, I was born in 74. So, yeah, I was around. And Holidays, that was my first Madonna song. Mm. And then ever since then, you know, just sort of followed. Look, I didn't become a real fan until, maybe Vogue. When Vogue came out, I'm like, oh, wow, this is awesome, and I'm now a fan. But until then, she was just there, but my sister liked Madonna, so I liked other things. But then after Vogue, I was like, okay, you've won me now. You've got me. And then that was it. And then I've just, you know, devoured everything ever since.
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of LGBT people idolize her. And it's not just for her artistry, because she's got a beautiful voice and she can dance a storm. And she's beautiful to watch and her shows are on video. But she's kind of a defiant, you know, to anything that looks institutional. I mean, she defies.
Absolutely.
Church, state, government. She's on her own and independent.
Absolutely, yeah. She's a rebel and a trailblazer, and understands the power of imagery too. Like, and I think that's a lot of the appeal. There's always such strong, bold imagery and fashion and makeup. But yeah, she knows the power of pop music's not just about the tunes. I mean, it is. It's about the tunes, and then it's about kind of imagery. And she's always nailed both of them. Always been very bold with both of those things.
So does that say something about Michael Griffiths, that you would choose to then do a tribute to her music?
Oh, look, funnily enough, after talking about strong injury, I don't dress up as her and I don't impersonate her and I don't do anything to make myself look like her or represent any of the imagery. It's strictly the music. And so I'm a pianist and I'm a composer and sort of had fun reinventing her songs for a sort of, you know, solo piano setting. And then because there's so many tunes, it's kind of the luxury of choice. My writer and I have kind of made, you know, a few medleys and we've smashed songs with each other. And you're in a lovely position with Madonna where you've got decades of material and, you know, bags of hits. I mean, so many that we couldn't fit them all in. But we have fun with our favorites. And it's very nostalgic. It's a lot of the early stuff, because that's when we were young, and that's the sort of music that's transported you, because it takes you to the 80s and to the 90s and the early noughties, which even the noughties are 20 years ago now. Isn't that mad?
That's crazy. That is crazy.
Yeah, a song from 2000 is, you know, nostalgic and vintage. Transportative. But yeah, we favor the stuff that takes us back to our youth.
I think that's very, very true. So I imagine you probably took Isla Bonita and made that into a torch song, yes?
You know what? I adore that song and that album. But again, when I talk about luxury choice and not having them all in, that one's not in there. Partly because as an Australian, my Spanish isn't very good. So like, I stumble across, I even just saying La Isla Bonita, I feel like a bit of a, you know, a sham thing. So that one's not in, but certainly there are other songs on that album. There's about two or three on from Like a Prayer. But not that one. Oh, no, that one's True Blue. God, I'm showing up my...
Yeah.
That one's on True Blue. Oh, whoops.
Actually, I don't even remember it. I think I have every one of her albums.
I have every one on multiple, you know, formats, mainly CD now, but I had them on. The first 7-inch single I ever bought was Live to Tell. Actually, oh, so then I talk about Vogue being the one. Maybe Live to Tell was where she won me, but I think I bought that in secret, whereas by Vogue, I was out and proud. About my fandom. But yeah, I had her on LP, cassette, and then CD.
Yeah, my other, I don't know if you do it, but Ray of Light, I just think is spectacular.
Oh, spectacular. Yeah, I do Ray of Light, and it is spectacular. And what a wonderful album. And yeah, just, right, I'm going electronica, let's do this.
Yeah, that is awesome.
Yes, fabulous.
Michael, we got to take a short break. Will you stick around for a bit?
Absolutely.
All right, coming up next, gang, we'll be talking to Michael Griffiths some more about his upcoming shows, and now we'll spend some time talking about his other tribute, Cole Porter, and the music of Cole Porter here on Channel Q.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive.
It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
The incredible voice of Michael Griffith singing Cole Porter's Night and Day. Welcome back, Michael. Glad to have you on the show.
Hey, John. Good to be here.
So, Cole Porter, I mean, I kind of know enough about Cole Porter to be dangerous to myself, but I love him. I love him. He was a gay man who married a woman at a time when it was not convenient to be gay, but he married a woman, and she never really frowned upon his homosexuality. In fact, some of their parties were known for the sex and the drugs and the party and the sounds and the music, and they were quite the hit in the roaring 20s 100 years ago.
Yeah, they were super modern. And I actually, what I've learned doing this show, and I'm embarrassed to admit I knew almost nothing about Cole Porter. This show, again, was kind of at a suggestion, although entirely different writer. And she said, Michael, you should sing Cole Porter songs that suit you, and I'll write you a show. I was like, okay. I knew Night and Day and Anything Goes, and that was about it. And yes, it's extraordinary, his story and his privilege and his situation. But I think him and Linda were actually kind of best mates. And yes, he was gay, and she'd had a fairly rocky marriage before Cole. And I think she was sort of just grateful to be with, you know, a kind man who, you know, looked after her. But I mean, I think it was fairly sexless, and certainly he was gay and, had his outrageous parties in Hollywood, men only, and film stars and army, you know, soldiers would go along, and Linda would just disappear for a few days.
Yeah, isn't that great? His wife.
Then,
they both come from very wealthy families. Linda, I remember, was from Kentucky, and Cole's family was from Indiana, and they had this incredible wealth 100 years ago that even survived the Great Depression. And they were known for these lavish, luxurious parties, kind of like a scene from Rosalind Russell's Anti-Mame, you know, there in New York City, the parties with the cross-dressers and the fantastic artists and the incredible people. That's the kind of parties they were known for. Do you know what Porter's favorite song was? I do. His favorite song.
Love for Sale?
Yes, you knew it.
Hooray, I passed the test.
You passed the call for it, yes.
So you'd hope that I would know that.
I hope you know it.
I learned a lot fast. I mean, I didn't know how to play or sing most of the songs, let alone his kind of life story. And I do the show in character, as if you're kind of spending an intimate hour with him, telling you just warts and telling you everything, telling you all the good stuff.
Yeah.
See, I learned a lot fast, but I did come across it and it stuck, because what an extraordinary song. And,
about a sex worker, about a street
worker. Well, I know, but sympathetically too, like from the point of view and, from, a likable, real character back when, you weren't allowed to sort of discuss those things, let alone make them sympathetic.
Right.
But what an extraordinary and melancholy, beautiful song. And that's definitely in the show, one of my favorites. Mm. But yeah, I love that that's his. And you know what? Queen Elizabeth's, the reigning Queen of England, what her favourite song of all time and all composer is.
No.
And it's Cole Porter, and it's Miss Otis Regrets.
Oh, Miss Otis Regrets, about a mobster killing a woman.
a society lady who gets in with the wrong crowd. And I love that. I think that's rather telling. But yes, that's a society lady that gets up to no good. That's what the song's about, and it's her demise.
A person that he made big on Broadway was Ethel Merman. He gave Ethel Merman her voice.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, with all the music around, I mean, not Ain't Misbehaving. Well, Kiss Me Kate, of course, was the big show that he wrote.
Yeah.
But, you know, all the music, I get a kick out of you. Just one of those things. It's the lovely. All these songs, they're so, the beat and the rhythm and the meter is incredible. It's poetry. It's incredible poetry.
It is poetry.
And
musically, too, it's equally musically and lyrically sophisticated. They're so dense and clever, and you know, and I mean, before he became the kind of the toast of Broadway, he was actually, for a little early period, he was sort of destined to be a serious classical composer, and he was sort of groomed by, a famous contemporary composer of the time, and I forget, it was Stravinsky, I think, sort of took him on when he was young, and so yeah, that was the way he was going, and then he kind of fell in love with popular, he'd always written popular songs, he'd done them at university, but that sort of suddenly became, you know, the path he took, but he had that strong musical, you know, sensibility, and so they're so sophisticated. It's the hardest thing I've ever done is learning these songs.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I come from a classical piano background, too, and a musical theatre background, so it kind of has pushed me to my absolute limit to do justice to them. But they deserve, you know, everything. They deserve your hardest work because they're, you know, they're works of genius, all of them.
Do you sing Anything Goes? I mean, the lyrics of Anything
Absolutely.
Goes. Okay, that, yeah, yeah. That
it's
alone.
The opening number. That was always going to be the opening number. Open with that and close with Night and Day, with Every Time We Say Goodbye as an encore. They were like the first songs to land, you know, structure of the show. But yeah, Anything Goes is just, it's perfect. And everyone loves it and knows it. And it's perfect kind of, it's a perfect song in because the very first lyric of the verse is Times Have Changed. I thought that's the perfect thing to start with a Cole Porter Show, singing that in 2020.
Times have changed.
It makes it immediate. It's like they certainly have, and they will continue to. Yeah, times have changed. And we've often rewound the clock. It's the perfect way in.
When they landed on Plymouth Rock. Look, I'm remembering my lyrics. It's amazing.
Well done, John. Yeah, and that's the verse. That's not, everyone knows the refrain. But that's the verse.
It's
doing well.
It's so true. When are your shows? Your show to Madonna and your show to Cole Porter. When are they here in Los Angeles?
Madonna is this coming Monday the 10th, yes. And then Cole is the following Tuesday, the 18th. So I have a little week apart where I disappear to San Diego and Palm Desert and then come back to Los Angeles.
And are you performing in San Diego and in Palm Desert?
I am. I'm doing Madonna and Cole Porter in all of those places.
Because we are broadcasting live in both of those places right now. So that's
Bringing both Madonna and Cole Porter to Martini's Above 4th in San Diego, two shows a week apart, and then in Palm Desert at the McKellen Theatre, both shows on the same day.
Do you have a website if people want to go and figure out what show is closest to them and where to see you?
I do. My website's Michael Griffiths, which is just my name, funnily enough, .co. So no M on the end because someone else stole that before I got a chance to. So you're MichaelGriffiths.co, they're on there. Or, you know, you can just Google the websites. Or from Los Angeles, it's CatalinaJazz.com or... There's another place you can go.
MichaelGriffiths.co.
.co, no M, because it's already used.
We will agree. Mate, I would love to meet you in person sometime. I love Cole Porter and Madonna. You and I share that in common. I would love to hear your music. I'm going to try to make it to the Cole Porter Show and see you.
Well, I hope you can, and come and say g'day, and we can reminisce.
Awesome.
trade some Cole Porter stories, because there's more where that came from.
I love it. Michael, enjoy your stay in Vegas, and we'll see you soon. Gang, when we come back, we'll be talking to Betsy Butler from the Women's Law Center about women's equality in 2020 here on Channel Q.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Modelo is your reward. Modelo, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Now, with the MLB app, you can get baseball your way. Pick your favorite team, your favorite players, and get customized highlights, stories, and breaking news right on your home feed. Follow the action with Game 10, where 3D replays add another dimension. Plus, notifications can keep you connected to every pitch, every hit, every game. The MLB app. Baseball, your way. Download it now for free from the App Store or Google Play. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
A little church for you, Betsy Butler. I know it's been a long time since you've been in a church, but that's "Oh Freedom" by the Golden Gospel Singers.
Well, it's also bright in here.
Gang, we're talking to Betsy Butler, former California State Assemblywoman, now at the Women's Law Center, and of course, a dear friend of yours truly for, I don't even know, 40 years?
Okay, not that old yet. I mean, you are turning 60 soon.
We met in 85.
No, couldn't have been. I was still in college. Okay. It was 88.
88, all right. 98, 2000. Babe, that's 32 years.
I know. That's you're getting really old. I don't know about the rest of us.
You're not. You still look as beautiful as the day I met
you. You're very generous.
All right. We are going to talk about women's equality, and that's kind of one of the reasons I played that song. It's a 100-year anniversary of women getting the right to vote.
Yeah.
And I thought, what better person to have in than the person at the Women's Law Center? You.
Well, the good thing is, you know, that women have nothing more to worry about. Everything's taken care of.
Oh, it's all done?
All right, let's go.
Check that off. Yeah. Women are equal.
Mm-hmm. Especially with this administration. You know, things are going so well.
Yeah, you know, when they give the Presidential Medal of Honor to Rush Limbaugh, it just tells you how good things are going.
Oh, my gosh.
I couldn't believe it when it happened.
My father was a Republican. He's no longer on this planet, but he was what they call a grand old party Republican.
Right.
So he was fiscally conservative, but very socially liberal.
Yeah.
And this was a man, I was born and raised in Sacramento. So unfortunately, I had the privilege of having Rush Limbaugh in my life much longer than the rest of you, because he actually started in Sacramento, right?
Oh.
And so when I was in high school, this is before radio or sound carrying through your house, because again, it was the 70s, right? And Rush Limbaugh, my dad would have a radio on in every room of the house.
With Rush Limbaugh?
Exactly. So you never missed a word while he was doing his Saturday and Sunday chores, right? But my dad was such a decent human being that he passed away in 2011. But, you know, the notion, he was also in the Air Force, but the notion that McCain would be treated the way he was by this president, that Rush Limbaugh and this whole party would get away with what's happening. I know my mom and I talk about it all the time, there's just no way he would be approving of what's happening in this country right
Absolutely
now.
Not.
Massive disrespect and lack of dignity, and in every day, it's something else.
It's something else. But, I mean, how do you explain Susan Collins, a senator from Maine, Republican? You know, she says that she's all there for pro-choice and women's equality, and then she votes for Brett Kavanaugh.
Right. I say write a check to her opponent and fast. I mean, seriously, let's get some of these people out. I mean, as much as the presidency is, you know, obviously a critical concern for us, the Senate is huge. We have 5 races. Really, I think we can maybe turn at least 2 of them, maybe 4. We need 4. So where are those 4?
Got to hold Doug Jones in Alabama, hopefully, but that's tough, right? I mean, he's in a really deep red state.
Yeah.
I think he's a good and decent man. I hope he does win re-election. But he did beat out a child predator, alleged child predator the last time around.
But we have a predator in the White House.
I know.
What does that
apparently
matter?
It doesn't seem to matter.
No, and all of his predator friends.
Yeah. I think it's possible to win Arizona. I think McSally will go down, definitely. I think it's possible to win Colorado.
Yeah.
I think Cory Gardner will go down. I think it's possible to win Maine, Susan Collins.
I know.
But like you said, we need one more, and that leaves Tillis in North Carolina, maybe.
And McGrath is running against the Turtle.
Turtle.
Yeah.
McConnell in Kentucky.
Exactly. So
I would love the Turtle to go down. I'd love Lindsey Graham to go down in South Carolina.
I think
those are more long shots, but I mean, we need 4. We need 4.
Well, you know, the only way the reason I'm the least bit hopeful is because of the midterms. I mean, yes. And you know what, this dovetails into our conversation, and I've known you long enough. You know, I've had the privilege of being John's friend for 30 some years, and John was so generous and put me on the board of Equality California, and then put me on the board of the Gay Men's Chorus of
Los Angeles. You served for the LGBT community as a straight ally.
Right.
So
I've had this front row seat to all the positive and negative things that have happened in this country. And really, it has been this period of time that I've been involved with the gay community up close and personal because of you mainly, has been such a a fascinating, it's been a privilege, really.
Thank you.
But what's interesting is I think you might have remembered me saying this from the very beginning, from when you got marriage to when you didn't get married, then you got marriage again. This is very similar to the women's movement, right? Mm. So we got choice, okay? Mm-hmm. And we've had to fight for it every day since. Mm-hmm. And I'm hopeful that this generation, particularly in this Me Too era, this generation will see different outcomes and have different perspective and different challenges than what I've had to endure and what you've had to endure,
whatever
people our age have had to endure with regard to discrimination and isolation and just, you know. But then you've got this president who's allowing people to be their worst selves.
Yeah, so. Bringing out the worst in the nation.
Yeah.
I agree. I mean, Roe versus Wade became law of the land in 1973, uh-huh. protecting the right to choose.
Right.
It now seems like the Supreme Court's not going to completely overturn it, but death by a thousand cuts.
Well, that's exactly. That's
over
exactly.
and over, keep paring it back.
Right. And that's at the California Women's Law Center, we've done a number of amicus briefs. Many states across the country are just doing incredibly ridiculous bills. Mm. You know, you have to bury the fetus. There's, I believe it's Indiana where there's legislation, I think 16 men have signed onto this, that said if you have an ectopic pregnancy, you have to put that embryo back into the uterus and save it. Otherwise, you've committed a murder.
Oh my God!
This doesn't
insane.
Even make any sense.
No,
right. So there's that kind of stuff going on in all these different states,
and mostly men, I assume. Right, men on these bills. Right,
right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And white ones.
Yeah. How does Indiana give us both Mike Pence and Pete Buttigieg? You know. Talk
well,
about
there's
a contrast.
Hope. Isn't there hope?
There is hope.
There's a city called Hope. So all those states are doing all these different pieces of legislation to hopefully get to the Supreme Court, which has now happened. So we will be hearing a case. And yeah, it will be death by a thousand cuts. But that's what they've been trying to do for a long time. And with the wrong president and the wrong Supreme Court and the wrong Congress, these things happen in this country. And so my whole thing about to the young people is those of us, you who fought for a lot of the LGBTQ rights that young LGBTQ people are now experiencing, and women, until this president, I think everyone got really lackadaisical and really secure that this is just a country that those things will always have abortion, will always have gay rights, that those things just won't go away here. Well, guess what? It takes one Trump and it's all
one
up
Trump
in the air.
And yeah. Mm-hmm. But I'm hopeful, like you say, 2018 was proof to me that a lot of people, center
woke
especially,
up.
Woke up and went, wait a minute, no, that's going too far to the
right.
Gave a speaker, Nancy Pelosi, and
right.
I'm hoping now in 2020, not only the White House, but the Senate, keep the House. That's how the Republicans will learn.
Right. Yeah. Well, and it's also one of those things that hopefully it's life-changing. So, you know, my good friend Ricardo Lara, who's now our insurance commissioner, was in college when Proposition 187 was happening. And so he was kind of lackadaisical about voting until that happened. And then from then on, he was going to vote in every election. Everybody knew he was going to vote.
It broke him up.
That's right.
And now he's our California State Insurance Commissioner.
Right. But then I hope that young people, that the Trump thing, that could be the one good thing about the Trump thing, that he's woken people up, and especially young people understand how important it is to vote.
Coming up next, gang, when we come back, more with Betsy Butler about women politics in the upcoming elections here on Channel Q. You like that, Bets? That's for you, baby. In the name of love.
Yeah, Valentine's Day is coming, so, you know.
You too.
We were supposed to get married. Do you remember that?
Yeah, but I turned out to be homosexual.
Well, there's that. But then we were going to have a kid, remember?
Yeah, and then I turned out to be HIV positive at the time. Yeah, that was the other deterrent. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, everything we plan just seems to fall to pieces.
Well, no, not necessarily.
We still got a good friendship going.
Yeah, that's right.
Talking to Betsy Butler from the California Women's Law Center. Did I say that right? CWLC?
You did. All right. That's right.
You are organization does a lot of work around sexual assault. I think the Brett Kavanaugh Supreme Court hearings really raised that issue to the front of people's minds. What can you tell us?
Well, so we do a lot of work regarding sexual assault, domestic violence, gender discrimination, and reproductive health. And the organization's been around for 30 years. So unfortunately, none of those items have been resolved
yet. What the heck have you people been doing over there?
And in fact, it's actually gotten a lot worse, as you can imagine. Because of
Trumpism.
What's happening at the national level, and then that trickles down. Yeah. So the California Law Center last year, we authored 6 amicus briefs and on sexual assault alone, but bringing it to the interests of your listeners. I just want to point out that the LGBTQ, that LGBTQ women experience sexual assault at the same or even higher rate as heterosexual women, but 44% of lesbians and 61% of bisexual women experience rape, physical violence, or stalking versus 35% of heterosexual women. So there's, and then there's just so many parts that, you know, when you've sustained a lifetime of discrimination, all of that comes to this. So the healthcare that you get and the psychological resources that are not available, all those things really also build into the trauma
right.
that this person has experienced.
Right. Well, sexual assault really has more to do about power than it has to do about sex, right? I mean, it's usually some guy is trying to assert authority or power over a person he considers to be less than himself.
Correct. And that he can get away with it, or that person can get away with it, right?
Right. And it marginalizes a person when they're treated that way.
Correct. So I also want to point out, too, that the among the LGBTQ community, transgender people and bisexual women face the highest risk of sexual violence, and over half will experience sexual violence in their lifetime, and it often happens at a young age. Among bisexual women who are rape survivors, 48% report the first incident between the ages of 11 and 17.
That's so amazing to me. I mean, when you're 11, you should be thinking about
childhood.
Harry Potter or, children's books, not...
Well, we also at the Women's Law Center are looking at child marriage, which, you know, in
child marriage? Yeah. Where? In Kentucky? Where? Sorry to the people of Louisville.
But in a state called California.
Really?
Yeah. There is no minimum age. Well, there is. If you have a parent, one parent and a judge sign off on your marriage as a minor here in California, you can get married at literally any age. And that is true across the country for the most part.
But is that a bizarre practice in certain religious sects? Or where does that – because I never hear about that. I mean, for a while it seemed like there were strange religious outliers that would happen.
Yeah. I'm actually doing an event. Next month on March 18th down in Orange County on child marriage, and we have four child marriage victims, survivors, who are going to be speaking and hearing their stories. It's all over the place. So one mother basically just got tired of her daughter and married her off to the 42-year-old down the street. Yes, there are religious aspects to some of this. A
42-year-old, well, like a 15-year-old?
Exactly. So it's basically pedophilia plus statutory rape, right? So
that's the way it is.
That's the way it is. Yeah, that's crazy. That's Jason using his voice box over there. He's got voice today, but he's got the box.
Oh, my gosh. it's horrible. And so the economic scenarios that then transpire for those girls, because ultimately they're going to go on to have numerous children, more likely than not, and how that impacts their lives.
Well, the history of marriage, of course, marriage at one time was about property. It wasn't about love, right? It was about people trying to combine estates, and people would marry people they didn't love, or especially royalty when they were trying to amass more of a kingdom. Certain princes and princesses were expected to marry for money. And it wasn't, I mean, marrying for love is something a creation of the last 100-plus years, but not thousands of years.
Yeah, but some of that still hasn't changed.
I know. But at least we got love in the equation now. Like, you should marry the person you love. Well, there's a novel 20th century idea.
Well, especially if it's your choice. So with child marriage, it is not your choice.
No, clearly not.
Yeah. So there's a number of organizations across the country that we're working to change it, and we've accomplished that in a few states, but not in California. So we have work to do there. We also did – excuse me. I have frogs in my throat.
So does Jason. Of course, his took root. He's got no voice.
Yeah. We also authored 9 separate briefs on domestic violence. Mm. So these are different cases happening across the country, but there's a lot of domestic violence among the LGBTQ community as well. Everyone, unfortunately, gets to deal with these levels of violence.
Yeah, I think to some degree, too, one of the things that's happened to LGBT people, it's now being more widely reported. And maybe that's part of the significant increase. For many decades, law enforcement would not take same-gender complaints. Mm-hmm. Like if two guys who were lovers or partners were engaged in fighting, law enforcement would just write it off as boys being boys. They wouldn't take it seriously.
Right. Well, I think West Hollywood is a great example of, I know you guys were training the sheriff's department a long time ago.
Yes. Yeah. To take same-gender complaints. Yeah,
So I think there's a lot of that. You know, there's still a lot of edification that needs to happen with within law enforcement, they need to take responsibility for domestic violence, for all of it.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, we've had people come to us, and I've had tapes of police officers telling women who have called them to their home, which that's the other problem. It's only a man coming, but a man coming to hear, take her report for her rape. And they're like, are you sure you didn't just drink too much? Mm. This is, you know, are you sure it wasn't consensual? Because it kind of sounds like, and they're just like, what are you talking about?
So, well, until, what was it, 1970 or 80, a wife could not report a husband for domestic violence. It was not, under California law, possible for a husband to commit sexual assault on a wife.
Right.
Up until like 80, I think it was.
Yeah, but do you remember, too, when Donald Trump was running for president, his lawyer said he, because remember, he raped his wife, the other one, Ivanka, whatever, right? Was that her name?
No, that's his daughter.
But, no, okay, sorry, what's?
I don't remember.
Anyway.
Jason probably knows, but he's not talking, so yeah.
What is it?
Ivana. Jared Hills.
So he raped her. And his lawyer said, well, you can rape your wife. Do you remember that during the election? I was like, no, you can't.
You can't. You really can't.
Like, what century are we in?
Sometimes I wonder.
Yeah.
Sometimes I wonder.
Well, they took us backwards. I mean, in so many directions.
Well, that is what reactionary politics does. I mean, right? I mean, in terms of the political spectrum, if you're in the center, you lean to the left, you end up going, you know, liberal and progressive. You lean to the right, you go conservative. You go ultra-right, it's reactionary, which is to try to turn time back to what it used to be. It never works well. Right. It never works.
I had a conversation one time with someone who said, oh, well, the radicals on either side. I go, well, there's kind of a difference. You know, my tree huggers aren't shooting abortion doctors. You know what I mean?
Like, exactly.
The other side is like so radical and so dangerous that
then they got guns.
Lots of guns.
lots of guns.
The one in the White House is making sure they get to keep them and never wants to do anything about it.
Coming up next, gang, when we come back, Jared Hill is going to be joining the conversation. We're going to have the three of us talking about elections and campaigns and where we are here on Channel Q. Miss Mahalia Jackson, singing We Shall Overcome.
Yes, Lord.
Women We Shall Overcome. African American History Month, Black History Month this month, We Shall Overcome. LGBT people, We Shall Overcome. We shall all overcome. Ah, I'm so ready to overcome Trumpism. That's right, baby. All right. Gang, we're in studio with Betsy Butler from the California Women's Law Center and Jared Hill, one of my favorite people in town.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yes.
I'm light. I will turn red. So.
Jared.
Yes.
You are covering the Iowa caucuses. You are covering New Hampshire tonight. Yeah, the debate. I know. What is going on?
I just got completely exasperated.
Are we going to have a Democratic nominee? I thought Pete Buttigieg would do well in Iowa. I didn't think he'd win by a sliver. I mean, I'm happy he won. But.
I mean, well, it depends on who you ask if he won, right?
Yeah, like, that's
so
true.
Apparently, the Democrats are calling for a re-canvassing.
Yeah, Tom Perez finally called for a re-canvassing.
I'm as exhausted with Iowa as I could possibly be.
And what is with caucuses? Can we like abandon that? What's the whole point?
I feel like if there's anything good that will come from this, it will be the fact that this was probably the last time we will do an Iowa caucus and the last time we will do them first.
Betsy, did you ever go to Iowa caucuses? I mean, when you were part of various presidential campaigns.
No, I stayed in California, but I've been to Iowa.
I mean, to me, it's like Red Rover, come on over. You like stand with one group, and then if you decide you want to go from Buttigieg over to Sanders, you just run across the room. And it's
I did find the pictures of the people who had been supporting Biden, and it dwindled down to like five.
Yeah.
That was interesting to me.
So there's so much interesting to talk about when it comes to caucusing, because there's a real argument to be made that Bernie Sanders won if we're looking at the first round, right? Because people came in wanting to vote for him. And then by the end of it and averaging everything out, it seems like Pete Buttigieg may have won. But if we were doing this weird thing that other states do called voting.
one person, one ballot.
Exactly. If we were doing that, it would be Bernie Sanders, right? And I've said multiple times before, I'm not a big Bernie fan, but there's an argument to be made that Bernie Sanders seemingly won that situation. But it's crazy to me that we still caucus. It's crazy to me that Iowa is still first. And I would imagine if they're going to figure out a way to do this better, that there will be multiple states that will go first in the future, as opposed to spending a year, year and a half for some people, right. Dumping hundreds of millions of dollars into Iowa for it to turn out like this now three times in the last
And the first
decade.
Two states, Iowa and New Hampshire, are predominantly white.
Well, that's my point, right?
They don't represent the rest of the country.
They don't look like the country, and they certainly don't look like the Democratic Party. So it doesn't really do anyone a service. Like, yes, they have chosen the right person that ended up becoming the nominee four times. That's really cute. But, like, it also, it disproportionately puts value on the Iowa voter and Iowa as an electorate.
You know, I know in the past that California and other states tried to move their primary up to get closer to Iowa. And every time the other states moved up, Iowa just pushed back further.
Yeah.
Like, they want to go first no matter what.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Well, I was just going to say, as someone who's run for office, I can't imagine having a March primary and a November election. Like,
it's forever.
Kill me now.
Forever.
Well, we have to find something in between what we do and what the British do, right? Like, the British in their six-week turnaround, they're like, so we're doing an election in 6 weeks. Y'all figure out who wants to run, but we're doing this on Thursday. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, there's so many ways that we can improve our voting here. Like, it doesn't make sense that we vote on a Tuesday, on one day.
No.
Right, when we could put it on a weekend. It doesn't make sense that we have a year, 2 years of campaigning. It doesn't make sense that we primary in this way. Like, there's a lot of things that we could do to fix voting. But also, like, I hate to say it sounds so cynical, but, like, voting is working the way that it's supposed to work, right? It's working the way that it was built. Voting is not supposed to include everyone, because if it was, it'd be a holiday. It'd be more open for people to be able
Australia.
To participate. Exactly.
Australia makes it a holiday. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, California just went to 30 days of voting, right?
Correct.
There's no longer polling places. It's like 30 days, but I'm afraid people don't know.
Well, I got my ballot and the booklet and all that kind of stuff in the mail this week, and I was like, damn, isn't this election like not until March? And I double checked it this morning. Actually, I was like, I think this is next month. And I was like, yes, okay, it's March 3rd. But yes, I mean, I think it's good for people to be able to have more time, because also a lot of people are not paying attention to this, right? Like, politicos like us are
live
completely
and breathe
immersed.
It. Yeah.
Exactly. I've been immersed in this for a year. And there are some people who are not going to pay attention. At Iowa, for instance, when that Iowa Des Moines Register poll didn't come out, they talk about the importance of that poll being the fact that so many people are undecided. And that is really demonstrated in caucusing, because so many people come into the caucus unsure who they want to vote for.
Right.
And then if you're watching the coverage of it, you'll hear someone say, like, they'll say, oh, I came over to Bernie from, you know, Amy Klobuchar or whoever. And they're like, oh, well, why did you come to Bernie? Well, their people got to me first, or their people were the loudest, or they look like they had the best party. Has nothing to do with policy.
Or there's the one woman, oh my God, I put it on my Facebook, the woman who had given the card or whatever for Pete. And she was, wait, he's gay? And I'm like, who are these people?
What's great about her, and like, she's a low information voter, right? Like,
clearly.
Completely removing anything about her politics or whatever. She's a low information voter, because she says, well, why didn't anyone say anything? And I was like,
is he hiding it?
I said, sweetheart, that's the whole reason we're here.
Yeah, I know.
If Pete Buttigieg were not gay, he would not have entered into the national scene.
Oh my God.
It was wild to me.
That is wild.
Yeah. And mortifying.
So I think Bernie's going to win New Hampshire. And then we go to South Carolina. Now, South Carolina, the Democratic Party is predominantly African American. Biden, for all purposes,
Pete Buttigieg ain't winning South Carolina. I can tell you that right now.
But do you think Biden's going to hold South Carolina? Where else does a black vote go in South Carolina?
Well, so this whole Iowa debacle has hurt Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg. But if it has helped anyone, it has been Joe Biden. Because Joe Biden came in as the great white hope of America, that he was the person that white moderates could vote for over
Donald
Trump.
By 30 points.
Exactly. We have been saying for months, like, Joe Biden is not an amazing candidate, right? I said to you on this show before, like, I cannot name one person that I know that is, like, thrilled for President Biden, that is excited to go vote for him. However, the way that this week has worked out, right, the caucus was on Monday. There was no result. Tuesday was the State of the Union. Mm. Wednesday was the acquittal of the president.
What a hell of a week.
Thursday, there was still half results, right? We kind of got results. And then they came back and said, we're going to re-canvass. So it has helped Joe Biden to not have a decisive loss just yet.
Right.
And that could help him in New Hampshire. It could help him in Nevada, South Carolina. But this whole week of Iowa has completely thrown everything out the window. New Hampshire seemingly becomes the start of the primary again.
Mm.
You know, which is also exhausting as I even say that.
I have to say, okay, I got my ballot too.
Yeah.
I have not returned it because I don't know who I'm voting for. I was a Kamala Harris guy, mm-hmm. and I still haven't decided who I'd support for president.
I'm kind of in that same boat. I feel like I kind of know who I want to vote for.
Okay, you're leaning Elizabeth, kinda. Right?
I've been leaning toward Warren, but I'm just not like, I like her a lot, don't get me wrong. I've had a lot of challenges with Bernie Sanders. I find him frustrating, but like policy wise, sure, girl, okay. But like him and the people that come along with him feel very analogous to the Trump supporter on the other side.
Absolutely.
It's exhausting.
Who are you with, Betsy? Have you decided?
Well, you know, I've been on a couple of different trains, but right now I'm on the Amy train.
I like Klobuchar.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. And here's why. I mean,
Well, hold on. We actually have to go for... Oh. See, when we come... Coming up next, okay. We'll hear Betsy's reason why she's with
the
Amy
conclusion.
Klobuchar. Okay. Stay tuned, gang, so you can hear here on Channel Q. That is the incredible Lauryn Hill singing Black Rage. I played that for you, baby. Played that for you, Jarrett.
It's funny. I have a very mixed relationship with that album.
I love that album.
Because I loved her first album so much, and then she came out and did this Unplugged album. We're like, what the hell songs are these? What is this? But it's aged well, and people like it a lot more than
I like
when
it
first came out.
Gang, we're talking to Jarrett Hill in studio and Betsy Butler from California Women's Law Center. And you were about to justify Amy Klobuchar. And during the break, we went from Amy Klobuchar all the way to Jeffrey Epstein in 4 minutes.
If that wasn't a podcast. Extra for you.
Woo. Well, no, I was just saying that although we live in the beautiful bubble that is California, it isn't the rest of the country. And so as much as we want someone very progressive and liberal to represent us, if you're most Californians, you know, when you look at who's been elected as president, you know, Bill Clinton was not a progressive.
And you worked in the Clinton White House.
I did. And
I got arrested in front of the Clinton White House while you were inside.
This is a story. And he still doesn't recall
when
that he said
in
to me.
In the Clinton White House?
She was in the Department of Commerce.
Yeah.
In the Clinton White House.
Ron Brown, 93 to 96.
Very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm good friends with Keith Boykin, who was in the Clinton White House.
Yeah. No, I mean, I went to Commerce because of Ron Brown. He got Bill Clinton elected. I was on those calls every Saturday morning.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I just don't know. I love Elizabeth. She's great. I just don't know that this country as a whole would vote for her. Of course, it depends upon who's going to be president and who the VP is. I think Amy would make a great VP.
If we do this right, 1 year from today, Donald Trump would not be president of the United States. 1 year from today, there'd be a new president assembling, a new administration.
Well, it'd be less than 1 year from today.
Yeah. January 20th would be the inauguration.
I just hope we all survive between now and
then. Girl, listen. I just hope I can get through the weekend at this point. You know what I mean? Like, it's one step at a time. But the thing about Amy Klobuchar is I don't think there's anything, like, bad about Amy Klobuchar. And, like, if she were the nominee, I'd happily vote for her. But I don't see her sparking enough enthusiasm to get people out to vote for her.
Okay, well, just remember, Bill Clinton didn't win a primary or a caucus or anything till, like, March or April. He didn't come in first for
completely
a long, long time. So I'm just saying, whoever's the front runner now isn't going to be it.
I totally get that and agree with you. There's a charisma about
Correct.
Bill Clinton that people have always liked, and I don't have to explain that to you at all, right? My favorite Bill Clinton story is having been at the Clinton Global Initiative, the university version that they had, and like seeing him across the room, and like people are losing their minds. And like, oh my God, Bill Clinton. And I was like, he was like on the complete other side of like moving toward all of us to shake our hands. And I was like, I mean, it's Bill Clinton, you guys. Calm down. I mean, I get it. But and then like he got a little closer and I was like,
I get it.
I mean, it's Bill Clinton, sure. And then he got a little closer and I was like, that is Bill Clinton. And then like by the time he was there, like, oh my God, Bill Clinton. Like I was so excited.
Right.
But there's a charisma about him that like that happens when you're in that space with him and you listen to him speak. But like Amy Klobuchar has always just felt so flat.
Right. Well, two things on that. First of all, I did Bill Clinton's campaign in Southern California, and that whole, you know, atmosphere that you're referring to was why he was 4 hours late to every event.
Yeah. I believe
he would not leave a room until every single, and it was way before selfies, by the
way. But to that end, that is Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah.
Like, right? You know what I mean? Like, everyone wants to take a selfie with Elizabeth Warren.
And Pete.
Pete too, but like, if Pete becomes the nominee, the Democrats have a big problem. Yeah. Because, like, I mean, I like Pete Buttigieg.
Bernie
I'm not
becomes
excited
a
about
nominee,
him.
We got a big problem.
Either
too.
One of them. Yeah, there's, like, there are major challenges that come along with either one of them as a candidate.
Oh,
again,
God.
Would vote for either one of them. But, like, the populace, like, the electorate, there's a lot of challenges with both of them.
Well, that's exactly, you know, I worked for Hillary Clinton in Cleveland, Ohio the last weekend of October. And I would go up to doorsteps, you know, women answer the door, and I said, okay, and they're Democrats. Okay, you're all set, ready to vote.
Yeah.
You know where to go? And they're like, oh, I won't vote for a woman for president. Okay, this is Cleveland, Ohio in 2016.
Yeah.
Three of them to my face.
Crazy. It's crazy to
that
me.
That is crazy.
Well, and like, I think about Pete Buttigieg, and I think like, okay, if he becomes the nominee, how long until there's some illicit sex scandal that comes out, right? That he and his...
Well, gang, I hate to break it to you, but Pete and I...
No. I mean, none of us would be surprised.
I was going to say, like, I've actually... There's already conversation about... The relationships that Pete Buttigieg may have had, right?
Yeah.
He's a 38-year-old man or something like that. Like, he's had relationships and relations outside of his husband, right?
Right.
And so, like, at what point is there, like, some crazy sex scandal, whether it's true or not?
Well, I mean, Donald Trump's got crazy sex scandals all around
but
him.
Pete Buttigieg is a gay man. And, you know, like, there's a thing about
a different
being,
standard, maybe.
Exactly. There's a
standard.
Thing about being gay that I don't think straight people tend to think about so much as, like, when you identify someone as gay, like, you immediately are talking about that person's sex life, as opposed to, like, knowing that assuming that a person is straight and whatever, but you never really have a conversation about their sex life unless it comes up, right? Mm. But me walking into the room as a gay man, you immediately know, oh, he sleeps with men. Or if I say I'm queer, oh, he sleeps, you know, with whomever. You know, like, queer is, like, such an umbrella term. But with Pete Buttigieg coming in as a gay candidate, you're immediately thinking about his sex.
Yeah.
And who he's sleeping with, who he's married to, who he loves, you know, who's the parent to his kid, that kind of thing, in a way that you don't with straight people.
Yeah. You know, there was some study that brought out a difference between lesbian candidates and gay men. Gay men suffer from what you described, Jared. Lesbians do not.
You
they
know
do
why?
Not, and they haven't for a long time.
Yeah.
Because lesbians have an access to patriarchy that gay men, it's a very different relationship with that patriarchy.
Well, but
because
also,
straight men look at them as one of us, kind of in a similar way.
Well, and also a lot of men are curious, wouldn't mind watching two women have sex.
Exactly.
In fact, I remember when I was working for Jerry Shipsky down in Long Beach, and Rick Zabur had just run for Congress there, and they'd done all this polling that said a gay man can't win, but a gay woman can, because... People down in Long Beach don't. I mean, it was fascinating.
Wait,
this was a long time
Sheila
ago.
Kuehl and I ran for assembly in 92. They did a survey, USC. With Sheila, it was pixie, delightful, cute. With John Duran, it was predator. All this like sexually laden stuff just because I was a man and she was
like,
a woman.
Yeah. There's a real dichotomy of like the butch lesbian, if you will, right? And like the flaming homosexual man.
Yeah.
Like they are the two extremes. But like with the butch lesbian, they are seen by the other guys. As like one of the guys, we're going to have beer, we're going to go out and watch football and all that kind of stuff. You're kind of like one of us and they feel comfortable with that. But with like the flaming homosexual, it's like, I can't relate to that at all because it's also associated with femininity and that's just not comfortable for people.
Our time has expired, gang. Oh. I want to thank you, Jared, for coming by.
Of course.
Chatting. Betsy, thank you for coming back.
We
got
to
wrap.
Oh, okay. Lovely to see you.
Gang, next Friday is Valentine's Day. We'll be having a big Valentine's Day show all about love, sex, and relations.
Mm.
See you next week here on Channel Q.